Thanks so much for having me here today, everybody. I'm really delighted to be here and get out of the ivory tower for a bit and be able to spend time with people who are actually doing real work in public health instead of just studying it like I do. Let's see how do I advance the, there we go. Okay, so what I'm talking about today, I think the title of my presentation alludes to water and health. Why do we care about water? Well, really, the origins of public health are really with controlling water supply and sanitation in cities. And so this is a chart here that shows the U.S. life expectancy at birth over the course of the 20th century. And probably all of you know that there were dramatic gains in life expectancy over the 20th century. And a couple of economists at Harvard, David Cutler and Grant Miller, did a study 10 years or so ago, and they attributed about 50% of the gains in basically life expectancy or overall mortality reduction to the provision of clean municipal drinking water. So on that chart, you'll see when the first drinking water chlorination plant was installed in Jersey City, New Jersey in 1908, and after that, many cities followed suit. So this was really, you know, getting drinking water cleaned up was really responsible for major health advances during the 20th century. And again, you all are aware of that. But what a lot of people aren't aware of, and that I, as an environmental engineer, wasn't really aware of until a few years ago, is that not everybody in the U.S. really has received those benefits of clean municipal drinking water, even if they live in relatively developed areas. So I, for the last several years, have been studying disparities in access to who has and doesn't have municipal water service. And all of this research was motivated by a conversation I had with your executive director, Dr. Jeff Engel, a number of years ago while he was serving as the director of public health for North Carolina. And we were working on a health impact assessment project completely unrelated to this work. And I just said, well, what are your some of your priorities? And he said that his priorities included studying issues of access to municipal water service. And I said, well, what do you mean? You know, I kind of assuming, well, can't everybody just turn on their water and assume it's, you know, good to go? And he told me about a survey that he had done of county health directors in North Carolina. I'm going to show you a couple of quotes from his survey. He had asked all 100 county health directors to respond to a question about whether there were communities that were underserved by municipal water and sanitation. And he only got responses from 39. He wanted to know, like, how many communities might be affected. There really was no quantitative information. But here's one quote from Pitt County, reporting on homes with privies, straight pipes, failing drain fields, or incomplete plumbing, severely limited soils with high water table, which obviously means that septic systems aren't functioning well in this county. Another county, Stokes County, in the north part of the state, the health director there, reported again clusters of homes with insufficient or failing septic systems, residences with cistern, spring, or no piped water to the home, which is shocking, clusters of homes with no available space remaining to install a replacement septic system or replacement well. So he just mentioned, you know, he's concerned about these kinds of communities that still don't have access to clean drinking water, but again, there was a lack of information in the state. So anyway, at Jeff's suggestion, I began looking into this a little bit, and he pointed me to a particular type of community that's underserved by water service. And just to motivate this a little bit, I'm showing you here an article from the New York Times. It was 2005, a while ago, but it describes well a situation that still exists in a number of communities. And what this article says is, so this article was published at the time the U.S. Open was about to be played at Pinehurst in North Carolina. It says, golf has made Moore County rich. That's where Pinehurst is. There are spas, country clubs, and new $2 million homes. The United States Open to be held later this month on the most famous of the county's 43 golf courses is expected to bring $124 million to the state. But as developers rush to provide resort-quality amenities in the newest subdivisions, some neighborhoods have been left behind without sewers, police service, garbage pickup, or even in some cases, piped water. These enclaves are virtually all black. They butt up against or even completely surrounded by affluent towns that are mostly white. So these are the kinds of communities motivated by Dr. Engel that I've been looking at over the last several years. I'm going to give you another example, and this is another case that's been kind of studied before I got to work on this research. And this is a town called Mebane, that's about 20 miles from Chapel Hill, where I live. And I'm going to show you several versions of this map, but let's see. There we go. Okay. So what this map is showing, it's showing the town of Mebane, and you can see over here. Is that it? Well, do you know how this thing, how this works? Is that showing up at all? It is showing up. I can't see it from here. Well, anyway, look at the yellow boundaries. Those are the boundaries of the town of Mebane. And what you'll notice is that they're somewhat irregular. And what you'll notice is that they tend to exclude the areas that are colored in orange. And those areas that are colored in orange are majority black communities. What you'll also notice is that there's a purple, light purple boundary that kind of encircles the yellow boundary. That light purple boundary is what's known as an extraterritorial jurisdiction, or on the key it says ETJ. What that means is in North Carolina, cities and towns are allowed to declare land that's up to 3 miles from their borders as an extraterritorial jurisdiction, and they are allowed to exercise complete zoning control and land use control in those areas, but they don't have to provide any municipal services to those areas, and the people who live there also don't get to vote in municipal elections, so they really don't have any political power. Now what I'm going to show you again is just highlighting that the municipal boundaries run right around these four different black communities in Mebane. So the city gets to control the land use. The folks there don't get to vote in the municipal election. Also, though, what happens, this is a map of just sewer lines in this case in the community, and there's some interesting things. There's the sewage treatment plant. And what you'll notice is that the sewer lines don't run into the black communities. So again, the city gets to control land use in these areas. The community members don't get to vote, and they also aren't entitled to city services. Now, that doesn't mean the city couldn't decide to extend services, but by law, they're not obligated to do so. So why do these communities exist? Again, I was shocked when Dr. Engel sort of pointed me in the direction of looking at these kinds of areas a few years ago. I didn't know about this at all, and I'm finding that not many people know about this situation. So I started reading some interesting research that's mostly been done by demographers, and I found a couple of interesting papers. And demographers have called this kind of practice underbounding. And it turns out there's been some demographic research going back to the mid-80s looking at this problem. And why is it that municipal boundaries were set in such a way? And what demographers have postulated is that basically this situation has arisen to maintain in certain communities the balance of power within local municipalities. In other words, if the municipalities were to draw their boundaries to include these communities, then they might not have any longer a majority white municipal government. So this is a quote just from one paper from a journal called Rural Sociology about a decade ago. Annexation of predominantly black fringe territory may unsettle the racial balance of power within local communities. So, and at about two decades before that, a demographer named Charles Aiken had documented this practice in Mississippi and called it, again, underbounding. So when I say underbounding, that's what I mean. It's the practice of drawing these sort of gerrymandered boundaries that exclude certain communities from municipal services. So after my conversations with Dr. Engel, you know, he said, well, we really have these anecdotal reports. There was the Pinehurst article. An organization called the Cedar Grove Institute had documented the situation in Mebane. Beyond that, really nobody knew. How extensive is this problem? Also, these are just anecdotal reports. Can we really systematically see if there's a role of race in these underbounding practices? And then what would be the impacts on health in these communities if they're excluded from access to municipal water service in particular? And why is it that they're still, you know, during this 21st century, not being provided with these services? So with his encouragement, I applied for a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant with him as my practice mentor and got that grant. And then, again, for the last few years have been studying these questions. So the first question, are there really racial disparities in access to water service? Can we really find out in North Carolina? Is there a statistically significant relationship between race and who has access? So for this question, I ended up having to focus on Wake County. I was able to focus only on this county because many of you might be aware, but right now it's really not possible to find out easily who has and doesn't have municipal water in the United States. Up until 1990, the census asked where people get their drinking water, whether it was from a well or a municipal source. But after the 1990 census, that question was dropped. Also, since 9/11, it's practically impossible to get information on where utility pipes run. And the other thing problem with utility pipe maps is even when you can get them, we found communities where the pipe runs right through the community, but there's no connections to the households. So that's really not adequate. So statewide, we didn't have a good source to tell us who has and doesn't have access to a regulated water supply. But Wake County, the second largest county in the state, location of the state capital, has really excellent property tax data that's not available in most places. So this lower map is just showing a, you know, zoom out of property parcels in Wake County. And for each of those parcels, you can get from the county information on the drinking water source. So that's why I started with Wake County. We looked at a number of other counties, and they didn't have this equivalent information. Again, there was nothing statewide. So what we did first is with my students, we mapped out where are the municipal boundaries. And in the map in yellow there, although it's a little washed out on the screen, kind of in the center of the county there, you'll see everywhere in those light colors in the center, that's areas that are within town boundaries, one of the municipalities in Wake County. Everywhere that's in gray, those aren't in municipal areas. And if it's not yellow or gray, they're in what that extraterritorial jurisdiction area, again, where the towns have claimed zoning authority over those areas, but they don't have to provide municipal services. Wow, this is hard to see. What I was hoping to show you is that in light blue around those yellow areas, it's not coming through here, but towns can elect to provide water service in some of those extraterritorial jurisdiction areas, and they do so, in some cases. But all of the areas with red and orange don't have municipal water, and they're in those extraterritorial jurisdictions. So they're sort of like the Mebane-type communities. The red ones are at least 50% black, and the white ones are less than, or the lighter orange ones are less than 50% black. So I'll just give you a picture of one of these neighborhoods. And this is a little parcel here. The red boundaries show the locations of residential parcels. And then the blue line is a municipal water line. And you can see it goes all the way around that community, but none of the households in that little parcel, and it's in right on the outskirts of Raleigh, have a connection to the municipal water line, or sewer, as it turns out. So they all have a well and a septic system in their backyard, even though, again, as you can see, they're encircled by this municipal water line. It's a small little neighborhood, just 66 residents. So those are the kinds of communities that we identified just through this mapping exercise. And then what we did is we said, well, okay, let's plot the relationship between the racial composition of these areas and whether they have water service. So what you'll see on this chart is the vertical axis is the proportion of households that have water service in a census block in these extraterritorial jurisdiction areas. And then on the horizontal is the proportion of the population that's African American. So you can see that relationship. As the African American population proportion increases, the access to water service decreases. And we did a statistical analysis, and this is a statistically significant relationship. So I don't know how these particular neighborhoods arose, but we do have this statistical evidence that there's some kind of a racial disparity here in access to regulated water service. So then the next question becomes, well, what are the impacts on health? So again, these households are relying on private wells. What does their water quality look like? And how do any problems with water quality affect health? So what we did then is just We had only a small amount of money to do limited sampling, but we were able to get enough money together to test about 60 homes for microbial indicator organisms and another 29 for lead. So we mailed out a recruitment letter to 1,000 households, and basically the first 57 that responded, we said, okay, we'll test your water for microbial contaminants, and then a subset we were able to test for lead. This picture here is just showing one of our participants on the left with my wonderful grad student, Frank Stillo, who's really coordinated this sampling effort, getting out into the field. And then on the right side is some undergrads that Frank trained to do microbial water quality analysis. So what did we find? Again, I just wanted to show you the locations where we recruited households. There are little red dots all over this map, and the color code's a little different from the last version, but the yellow areas are all these extraterritorial jurisdiction neighborhoods that are majority African-American and don't have water, and you can just see we tried to recruit households from throughout the county to kind of get a representation. The racial composition of these households that participated, here's what they report. We asked, you know, we gave them a survey also and asked about their race and income. What you'll notice is it's a lot less white than the county. So whereas 52% of the county identifies as white, 25% of these survey or these participants were white. 30%, interestingly, didn't want us to record their race. 46% identified as African American. What you'll also notice is the income is lower than in the county as a whole. The median income is $40,000 as compared to $64,000 median income in the county, and 19% have incomes below the poverty line. So relative to the county, these are minority, lower income households. So we got this water quality information, and then we also wanted to figure out, well, how can we estimate what risks might be? And I'll give you the results of the sampling in a moment. But what we did is, for this risk estimate, we didn't have enough resources to track people, but what we were able to do is get from the state information on emergency department visits for acute gastrointestinal illness through a statewide database called NCDetect, and also private well sampling data from across the state to look at relationships between private well contamination and health, and that's how we estimated health risks. I'm not going to go into the details of that. I heard Aaron Fleischauer's name mentioned, and I'm really grateful for him because he's the one who made it possible for us to get the NCDetect data. But this result is published in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives about a year ago. So any of you who are into methods, like risk assessment methods, if you contact me, I can send you the journal article or explain how we did this. For lead, we also wanted to, again, we sampled for lead. We wanted to say what might the impacts be because we don't have resources yet to actually, you know, do a proper epi study. So this is all just predictive. And we used a model that the EPA uses that it's called a physiologically based pharmacokinetic model. And what it does is it tracks intake of lead through various exposure sources and then looks at what happens to the distribution of lead in the body. We just looked at water, assuming there are no other sources. And so, you know, what happens if people ingest water with lead in it? What lead level do you expect to see in blood? So I'll get to the results in a minute. Again, we didn't look at the other possible sources. So for results, this is the results from our bacterial sampling of water. And what the vertical axis shows is the fraction of these households that tested positive. So again, we tested 57 households. These are the fraction testing positive for various bacteria that indicate there might be fecal contamination. And what you'll see on the far right is that 65% of households tested positive for at least one of the three bacterial indicator species that we tested for. So that's really high. And then what we're comparing this with is municipal water samples. And you can see well under 1% of municipal samples tested positive for indicator species. So there's definitely a disparity in the microbial quality of the drinking water that these communities are receiving. What does it mean for health? Again, I can refer you to my original paper from Environmental Health Perspectives, or just this January we had the paper on these communities come out in American Journal of Public Health, but we estimated that the contamination levels that we found in these wells would be enough to increase risks of acute gastrointestinal illness by a little over 20%. So again, we were looking specifically at emergency department visits, and we estimated there's about 3,800 people in these underserved black communities of Wake County, and we'd expect about 114 emergency department visits for acute gastrointestinal illness among this population, and about 25 of those would be attributable to their drinking water. So again, for methods, I'm happy to talk about that afterwards. For lead, we tested again 29 households. We took two samples in each, and seven of them, both samples were above the EPA action level of 15 parts per billion. In another household, one of the samples was above, and I will say that this is comparable to the lead prevalence that was observed in Flint, where they had about 28 to 30% of households above the action level. So here we have 7 out of 29 households above the action level for lead at their tap. And this is, again, their tap water that we're sampling. Going forward, I'm planning to do some work. Actually, I've gotten a little bit of support to go ahead this year and actually monitor children's blood lead levels in a small sample of these houses. But for now, all we could do is, again, this predictive monitoring modeling. So in this chart, I'm showing basically the 29 households by the random ID that we gave them. And this is, again, what just this EPA pharmacokinetic model would predict. The orange shows the contribution of the water lead levels that we found to what we'd expect to see in the blood lead of an 18-month-old child. In blue is just the average blood lead nationwide in 18-month-old children, according to the CDC. So this estimate I wanted to point out would say that, okay, in one household, the water alone would be enough to elevate lead above the CDC reference level. But we're not accounting here for other sources. A lot of these are old houses. And so one of the things I want to do going forward is also test for dust and paint. So this is just water alone. And as all of you probably know, lead at any level really isn't good for children. There's a lot of recent research showing at even very low levels, lead exposure during early childhood is associated with IQ loss. So we kind of did some predictive work to estimate what that might be for these different households. And you see in the most exposed household, what this chart shows is what the IQ loss we would expect to see in the different households. Wow, that's hard to see. But anyway, in the worst household, it would be about 3.5 IQ points lost. And then you can see, though, even at low levels, you know, in the other households, we'd expect to see some IQ loss associated with lead exposure. So the last thing that I wanted to look at was, why is it that in the 21st century, you know, nothing's been done about serving these communities with municipal water? As I showed you that map, many of them are just completely encircled by water lines. And again, we've seen some even where the water line runs right through the community, but the households aren't tapped in. So why not? So one of my wonderful grad students, MSPH students, went and did key informant interviews in three different communities. And she recruited communities that are in this type of situation where there's disparities in access to municipal services. And she went to three different parts of the state, as you can see, east, central, and west. Did very extended sort of open-ended interviews, and this is a qualitative research. So then she coded the interviews using some qualitative research software and then used that to see, well, what kinds of themes are really coming up. And she really sought to get a variety of perspectives. She interviewed 25 people altogether. There were 4 elected officials, including one mayor, 3 county commissioners, 21 non-elected interviewees, including 15 government representatives of government agencies and utilities, including health department personnel, and 6 community members. And then again, what she did is she just coded the frequency with which various themes arose. This is a common method used in qualitative research. What I wanted to point out, this is the chart with her results, and there's a lot going on here, but on the left side are all the subjects that came up in these interviews, the topics. And there's a lot of them. But at the very top is cost. So that seems to really be a driver. You know, municipalities and utilities say we can't afford to extend water connections into these communities. In my own town, Chapel Hill, there's a community that's been in this situation for a long time. And the utility there, when I've talked to them, they say, well, we're not allowed to charge our current customers for the cost of extending infrastructure to new households. So cost is a big deal. But what was really surprising is how many people mentioned health risk. So down here at the bottom, you'll see awareness of health risk. Health risk really only came up, you know, a little bit. A lot of the interviewees really just didn't mention it, which seems to suggest that there's really low awareness among some of the key decision makers that these disparities in infrastructure could be leading to health risk. And there was one of the three communities that she interviewed had just made the decision to go ahead and extend services to the underserved community. And so a quote, this was the New Hanover County community in the eastern part of the state. I think this quote from her interviews really illustrates kind of the thinking. It says, "I think the health director saying this is a community health hazard, that means you've got to take care of it. That ended the argument." So in the view of this county official who voted to extend services, it was really the health director coming in and saying, look, we've got all these failing septic systems, and right next to them we've got under-designed wells, and this could be a health hazard for all of us, really influenced the decision. So just to wrap up here, I have found in my research that there are statistically significant disparities in who has and doesn't have municipal water service in urbanized areas of Wake County, North Carolina. Specifically, every 10% increase in the black population proportion decreases the odds that a particular household would have water service by about 4%. These disparities appear to increase risks of exposure to both microbial contaminants and lead compared to what these people would get if they were connected to the municipal water utility. And this, again, can lead to some health impacts that we might care about, ought to care about. But decision maker awareness of these issues, in particular the health impact, seems to be really low. And then I just wanted to point out also, so I've been focusing on North Carolina, but as I began to read about North Carolina, I also began to read about other areas. And these problems aren't just a southern problem either. So I'm just showing a couple of pictures. The one on the left is from a New York Times article from the Central Valley of California, where there's been a lot of research now also showing similar disparities in access to municipal services among migrant farm worker communities in particular. So this household is taking a delivery of bottled water after their well ran dry during the drought. So they had no running water in their household as a result of the drought. And this community is, again, right next to a town that could extend infrastructure if it wished to do so. This is a picture from Alaska, where this is a kitchen, and the big bucket there, the big trash bucket, is holding water that the residents of this particular household have to go and collect from what's called a washateria. So this house has no piped water. So these problems exist not just in North Carolina or not just in the South, but they really exist in other places around the nation also. And then I've thought about, you know, what is a role for state epidemiologists? And certainly, again, from our interviews, it appears that there's low awareness of these problems. So I think just talking about it to decision makers and pointing out that there could be a health hazard could be really important. Now, in the case of the New Hanover County situation, the health department had actually gone and mapped all the failing septic systems. They went on site, they found where all the septic systems were, and there was a huge proportion of them that were failing. And then I thought, you know, beyond this, I feel like I'm just beginning to scratch the surface of this problem, and a lot more sort of manpower focused on looking at trying to figure out where these kinds of disparities exist and really where could the funding come from to provide water to these communities, I think would be a really great thing. And let's see, I wanted to acknowledge funding sources, first of all, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and a small faculty development grant from the University of North Carolina. And then I've had just a wonderful crew of students who have helped out with all of this. It turns out it kind of looks easy when I show the maps, but just creating those maps was a lot of work to figure out where we could even get information, and then water sampling required a lot of visits to households and interacting with community members. And so I've had this terrific group of students that I want to thank. And if any of you are interested in more more information on this or you want to see some of our data, we've got 4 publications out on these particular issues, and then I also have an enormous bibliography now of other related research, the research by demographers, and also research on these kinds of disparities elsewhere. So I'm happy to share that with anybody who's interested. And with that, that's all I have to say. So I don't know if you want me to take questions now or... Okay.